Welcome to the Savvy Dentist Podcast with Dr. Jesse Green, the show where great dentistry meets great business. Listen in each week as we bring you an inspiring person who will share their story, ideas, and business techniques to help you create a practice and a life you love. And now introducing your host, Dr. Jesse Green.
Hey guys, Jesse Green here. Welcome back to the Savvy Dentist Podcast, the show where great dentistry meets great business. Super delighted to have you here with us this week, and I'm just as excited to be having a conversation with Dr. Chris Phelps all the way from North Carolina in the United States. Chris is well known in social media circles. He's done a lot and seen a lot, and he's got the t-shirt. And we're going to be talking a lot about the things he's done well in his practice, as well as some of the missteps and boo-boos he's made along the way. Chris started in practice very quickly after leaving dental school. He found himself a business owner at a young age and was able to basically 10x his practices. So in our conversation today, I wanted to get down and dirty and ask him exactly some of the things that he did to achieve that result, because it is a fabulous result, and we wanted to get practical and tactical so that you can take some of the things he shares and talks about so that you can apply them in your own business. Now, I know that these things work because we do them in our practice too. So I guarantee you, you're going to want to have a pen and paper handy, because make sure you do take action on the things that he shares. Some of you will also know that Chris is the author of How to Grow Your Dental Membership Plan. So apart from talking about marketing, apart from talking about persuasion, we're going to touch on dental membership plans as well and the place that they have in the modern dental practice. So it's a really fun and interesting conversation. Now, some of you may know that Chris is coming to Australia to talk, and you might want to check out his website, strategicpracticeaustralia.com/events. And if you use the code SAVVY, you'll save yourself 15% off the registration price set. So that'll be a good event to get to. For newer listeners to our podcast, please do head across to the Savvy Dentist Facebook group. You'll find us there where we offer training, tools, tips, and practical things to help you grow your practice. So we'd love you to come and join us, and we can offer you some support in that space as well. But for now, it's over to Dr. Chris Phelps and all that he has to share about marketing, persuasion, and membership plans. Here he is. Dr. Chris Phelps, thank you so much for taking the time out of your day to come and hang with us. How are things rocking all the way in North Carolina?
Oh, thanks, Jesse. Things are going well. Obviously, our industry has seen a lot of changes in dentistry. From a technology standpoint, obviously, we all know it's changed more in the last 5 years than it has probably in the last 50 years. But even from a practice profession standpoint, you know, a lot more pressures today than we used to have. But the good news is the future is still bright. You better put on your shades.
Yeah, well, that's fantastic, because I really love that sunny disposition, Chris, because it's easy when you see things changing to go, oh, it was much better 10 years ago, and you feel a bit sad about things. But I actually think when there's change, there's opportunity. And it's being adept at spotting opportunities and being able to capitalize on those opportunities. It's going to set people apart.
Oh, by far. One of my great mentors once told me, you know, if you're not growing, you're dying. And so I'm always looking for those growth opportunities and trying not to stay stagnant, because things change. I mean, that's the only thing we can count on besides death and taxes. So instead of fighting the power, let's roll with the punches and just keep growing.
Yeah, I really resonate with that. Hey, Chris, I do want to take a little bit of a trip down memory lane, because in preparation for our conversation today, I've listened to some of your previous interviews. I've read some of the things on your website, and you've got a couple of websites that we're just talking off air. You've obviously got strategicpracticeaustralia.com and another one, Dr. Phelps Helps, which I really love, because I tried saying that really quickly over and over, and it's a bit of a tongue twister. But one of the things I really admire about you is you're a real world dentist. It's not academic theory. Yeah, you've achieved great results in practice. It's not management theory. It's not stuff from a book. And so I read that you got out of university pretty quickly and found yourself in practice fairly swiftly straight out of dental school. And I'm wondering, firstly, how was that dive into the deep end for you? And obviously you made a good success of it, but for the people listening to our show who might be just starting their journey, I'm wondering if you can tell a little bit about your story, because I think they'll be able to latch onto some of the things that you did well. And equally, if there's any missteps or boo-boos along the way, what can they take from that?
Yeah, definitely. Let's flash back 15 years ago, which is hard to believe.
Oh, come on. You look like you're 25. Look at you. You're fresh-faced, baby-face. It's great.
I still feel that. Thank you. I still feel that way. But my joints are clicking a little more than they used to, though. So
fair enough.
15 years ago, I got out of school. And I think, you know, one of the things I've always been appreciative of was I had a clear vision, even from the get-go. I knew where I wanted to go. The GPS was set. And my mindset back then was of growth. And for the good of it was growth. The bad of it was growth for growth's sake. It really isn't a good thing. So I was dead set on this vision of having multiple practices and growing those things and creating an empire, right? First Charlotte, then the world kind of thing was kind of my mindset back then. And I was very fortunate that my wife, we got married before I went to dental school, and I kind of hung out with her dentist back in Charlotte, North Carolina, and talked to him a couple times. But he just had a really unique, scarce opportunity, which I couldn't pass up. And I thought he had a huge opportunity in front of him, even though he didn't see it. And so I spent a lot of time hanging with him and this whole time in my dental school, hoping that he was going to ask me to join him and be an associate. And then I could start my practice life there right out of school. And when it came down to literally like 3 months before I'm supposed to graduate, and he was nice enough to let me use his practice to screen my own family and friends, because after you graduate dental school, we have the state licensing board. So you have to take patients before where the state that you're going to practice in, and they make you jump through all these clinical hoops and then give you a license to actually practice dentistry. Because dental school apparently wasn't enough. So I'm sitting there screening my family and friends trying to find these patients. And I'm talking to Tom, who was the dentist, and I said, I was kind of hinting around that I was going to be graduating. I was still looking for work and was looking for a good opportunity, and was hoping he was going to ask me to come join him. And I realized in that moment, he wasn't going to do it. I just kind of took it upon myself, and I was like, all right, screw it. I'm just going to throw it out there. And I said, so Tom, what do you think about me joining you? He was very unassuming. He was a great guy. He just said, well, I'm not going to lie. I had associates in the past. None of them worked out. But you're welcome to come try. And now, while most of you may be sitting there thinking to yourself, wow, that doesn't sound very good, right? That's not a very winning proposition. What I heard was, so you're saying there's a chance. Okay, I saw opportunity, right? That's more the optimistic side of me. Because I felt like he had something unique in that he, in the States, he had dropped all of his insurance plans, and he was truly a fee-for-service dentist. So he might charge $200 for his cleaning, exam, and x-ray, and he got paid $200 that day. Then he filed the insurance as a courtesy for the patient, and they waited on the reimbursement money. Same for his crowns. And nobody else around him had that. So I saw the opportunity there, but he was limited by his capacity in that he was in an old house that he had renovated to a dental office. And it only had like 5 chairs, right? And it was only open a couple of days, you know, 4 days a week. When I decided to go in with him, the two things he always did for me, which I always appreciated, was he never treated me like an employee, even though for the first 6 months I was. I had an agreement to buy in at 6 months as a partner if we liked each other and we felt like it was going to work out. But for those first 6 months, I was an employee, but he never treated me that way. He always treated me like a partner. He wanted me involved with decision making and what the next move of the practice was from day one. But really, he let me spend his money on my marketing ideas to get myself opportunities. Because the reason that it didn't work out with his other associates that I realize now was that he didn't have enough patients. He had no idea what his patient attrition rate was, meaning how many people got their teeth cleaned this time last year that aren't here this year, that are gone for whatever reason. And he just thought that he could just step back and work a day less or whatever, and his patients would just go to the new guy. Well, knowing what I know about the principle of scarcity, when you become the scarce resource, people don't go to the next guy. Suddenly they want you more and they'll wait to get you. They'll even pay more to get you. So that's why it never worked out with those other associates. So he actually let me spend his money on my ideas. And I still remember, I have to send you my first advertisement I designed on Microsoft Publisher myself. And it was so generic and simple, it was ridiculous. But I put it out there and it got myself opportunities, and I doubled the business that year. And so we realized fairly quickly that this was going to work. And so from there, I literally built those 4 offices initially off marketing. We did our first startup was the second office. I was literally sitting at a stoplight with my wife, and we were looking for a new house at the time. And she was showing me the neighborhood and the area she was interested in. And I remember seeing this intersection. And after looking at all these houses and the growth, and there was already a dentist going into there, right? It's a dentist coming soon. And I thought, even though there's nothing on these other 3 corners and there's already a dentist going in here, I got to have a practice here. This gut feeling like I needed to be there.
So just to interrupt you just for a second, did you get the house for your wife at the same time? I'm curious.
I did.
Good.
Oh, yeah.
Happy wife, happy life, mate.
Exactly. So, and that's why I said, I don't care where we live, you pick it out. As soon as I saw that, I thought, we got to do this here. And we did. We started from scratch, and We did over 1 million in collections that first year and 2 million by year two. I hired two associates for that practice from day one with no guaranteed patients. Maybe I watched Field of Dreams too many times. You know, if you build it, they will come. And that's what I felt. I felt if I build it and I know how to promote it and market it, they're going to come and we're going to be fine. So I would say those early years, and you know, that's how we 10 times the revenue. It went from 600,000. It was what the practice did the year before I joined it, to doing 6.5 million in revenue between the four offices within 7 years. So a lot of growth along the way. But as you said, the mistakes and the missteps I made were still being too reactive in my decision-making, not being proactive enough, not being more forward-thinking. And I got stuck in that lull of, because my partners were kind of with the mindset of reactivity. They fight change and uncertainty sometimes.
So with these new practices, was Tom a partner in those as well?
He was. And then it was kind of right around year three, I believe, or four, I can't remember. Each of us sold half of our half of the business to one of the associates. So we had four equal partners, which was kind of nice for me because I sold half of my half of the business for four times what I paid for the half 3 years earlier.
That's a good ROI.
Yeah, that's a good return, right? So it literally cost me nothing to start out, in essence. So, and then I was able to use that money in real estate and some other cool areas. But I realized along the way that it's an old adage in the States, when you have too many chiefs and not enough Indians, too many chefs in the kitchen, if you will. And it was fine. And everybody's opinion was valid. And when we came together and made a decision together, it was always a really good decision. But what happened was, time went on, was everybody really appreciated their way of doing things more. And it, as a group, it became clear we had a divide. It was Tom and I were always on the same side, and the other two docs were always on opposite sides of how we wanted to do things for the practices. And so when you got four offices, and I'm still doing clinical dentistry 5 days a week, producing over 1.2 million myself, on top of that, running the marketing, running the businesses, I realized that I almost trapped myself in the business itself. And it was going to overtake me if I didn't do something about it. So I decided that because of that equal power, I saw our growth kind of go from this to kind of flatline a little bit, and was just starting to go the other way. And I thought, well, if we can't make some simple changes today to protect us for tomorrow, again, going back to being proactive, our growth is going to crush us, right? 5 years from now. But I couldn't get them to see that vision, right? Which is fine. So I said, look, we're not married and we're certainly not related. So nobody says we have to stay together. So I made a pretty radical decision. I decided to sell my two best offices to them. And I took over the two worst ones. One of which was Cold Start Office. It was only collecting around $35,000 a month with one associate in there, but it was costing me $70,000 a month in expense.
Going backwards.
Right. Yeah. You don't have to be a math major to realize that's not a good deal, you know? And when you had other offices and partners, it's an investment, but when it's you and your original partner in one other office, now it's a problem. So I knew I had to dive into the thing and figure out what my problems were. So a misstep would have been probably making it too good a deal for the other side and too big a hole to climb out of for myself. But I like a challenge. And it, like I said, it was a powerful motivator to not let anything be an excuse and to make stuff happen, right? Necessity is the mother of expense. So part of it was my marketing stuff. You know, I'm spending $36,000 a month in marketing, but getting 60 patients, 30 at one office and 30 at the other. And that's, again, that's a lot of money for not a lot of return.
Huge amount of money.
Huge amount. And so I knew something was wrong, but I didn't know why. I couldn't get to the root cause of the problem. Was it the ads not bringing in the leads? Was it the quality of the people they brought in and people didn't spend enough to justify the expense? Or was it the other side of the coin, which was my team didn't answer the phone or they didn't make appointments? Or is it both? But either way, I needed to figure it out. So that's kind of how my call tracker ROI system got created, because I tried everybody's system out there to track marketing, but nobody, in my opinion, really solved the problem. They kind of scratched at the truth, but they didn't give me the whole truth and what I needed to really get to the why of what's wrong, because then I could figure out from there what I needed to do next and what the strategy was going to be. So I decided to develop my own platform. And once I got the data I needed, I was able to make smarter decisions.
What was the problem in the end?
Well, for me, it was two parts. We did not answer 220 new patient phone calls a month.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And when we did answer the telephone, we only made an appointment 24% of the time.
So what's the average? What's the average new patient worth in that practice? Just, I'm trying to put a financial metric to what that loss was.
Yeah. $1,254 a year.
Ooh, that hurts.
That hurts. And again, when I started listening to the phone calls and hearing what my team was telling potential patients, it's sickening. I don't have any other way to say it, right? It's like a punch in the gut. And you'd like, why would you ever tell somebody that? Like, that makes no sense. But that's what it is, what it is, right? So I realized that was my problem and I had to dig into it. So I tried to create strategies on, I look for patterns. Why are we missing the phone calls? When are we missing? Was there a rhyme or reason to it? I immediately hired a third person for the front desk, right? To try to, let's get more bodies on the problem. Let's make sure they're here when we're closed or during lunch when people are calling and we're not answering. I tried everything I could think of to squelch that piece of the problem. So the missed calls went down. And then I spent a lot of time analyzing those phone calls and realizing, well, what's the real problem here? And half the time it was the patients putting up barriers to scheduling. But at the same time, the other half of the time it was my team putting up the barriers, prejudging the people they're talking to and assuming they think they know what they need when in fact, neither party know what they need. Instead of just getting them in for an appointment and then we'll figure it out when they get here. So once I rectified that, I had my team converting over 80% within the next 3 months. So you answer more calls and you schedule more appointments. That's how my new patient number went to over 300 a month instead of 60.
It's an interesting point, isn't it? Because just for the front desk people who might be listening to this podcast, it's really interesting because one of the things we talk about, Chris, is it's always selling the next step, not the whole process, not the series of steps. And the next step is simply to make an appointment to get them in the door. And we'll take it from there.
Exactly. And truthfully, the more you dig into that problem, and I told my team this too, I said, look, I know you're freaking out because I'm going to have somebody listening to the phone calls because that's what my service does. We listen to them because I didn't have time to get the data myself. But I said, look, I'm not using it to fire you. That's not what this is for. This is for, I got to find out what the problem is so I can do to give you the tools you need to be successful in this position. And I haven't done that. The blame is mine. It's nobody else's. But if I don't know what the problem is, I can't fix it. And in fact, then I realized that the role at the front desk is, it's a mismatch with how people are built instinctively that we hire for that position. And it's really the front desk role and all the things we make them do was built for yesterday's dental practice, but it's really not built for tomorrow's. Not really. So then I started outsourcing more things. So I said, well, let's get all these things off your plate. Because to me, the most important job of the front desk is to take care of the existing new patient or take care of the existing patient, make sure they have a great experience and make sure they leave with their next appointment. That's their only job, in my opinion. That's the most important thing.
Interesting there. Sorry to interrupt you again, mate. Again, you measure rebooking rate off that?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So for me, if there was only one statistic I could have in a practice, and I realize that there are many more data points, I get that. But if there was only one, it would be that one.
Definitely. That's huge, right? And again, going back to that patient attrition number. So if we take care of people and make sure they're all coming back and I'm not losing people every month, then that's less in marketing I got to spend to replace them. So it works on both ends of the coin. And so my scheduling service, Golden Goose Scheduling, I built that because I needed a team to take care of those new patient calls for me and get it off my team's plate. And it's amazing how happier they got and how much better they got at their job when they stop having to do 10 things every day. So that was definitely, those are some valuable lessons learned. It was kind of funny. And then I changed my mindset, like we said earlier, from growing for growth's sake to, well, now I'm down to half the offices. Can I maximize the capacity of those offices now? Because in my thought, I set a challenge for myself. Can I do with two offices, collections-wise, what I used to do with four? And when I took them over, they were doing about $1.6 million between the two of them. And 3 years later, I had them doing $6 million. So again, doing with two revenue-wise, what I used to do with four. Okay, so maximizing their capacity and really focusing on that and making sure we looked at not only I figured out the marketing side, but then also on the case acceptance side. Well, because if we don't get more people back for treatment, it's still a wasted marketing expense.
Yeah, you might have a full book, but it's not productive, right?
Right. So that lost opportunity, because if we're not closing on cases and they're not coming back for treatment, to me, it's still a wasted marketing expense. So I spent a lot of time studying the science of influence and persuasion and trying to make a scientific process out of how do we increase our case acceptance? How do we get more patients actually showing up for their appointments like they said they would? How do we set the stage for more referrals? You know, the problems that we were having in my practice and your practice, there's got to be a strategy to fix these things.
You spoke about one of those principles of influence a moment ago, which was scarcity. You spoke about, you know, when the principal dentist winds back their time becomes more scarce and therefore they're suddenly more attractive as a perverse kind of consequence of that. So you've touched on the principle of influence, and I know you've worked with Dr. Cialdini, Robert Cialdini. Tell me a little bit about how you found that experience and what effect it had, because I've been a fan of Dr. Cialdini's work for as long as I can remember. and it's been seminal in the stuff that's helped me. And I'm curious, has it had such a profound impact for you as it has for me?
Oh, God, life-changing. Life-changing, practice-changing, you name it. And I still remember, again, after selling the two best ones and being stuck in with the problems of the two worst ones, that's when I heard Dr. Cialdini speak for the first time on these six principles. And reciprocity is one of those. If you give people gifts of value, they tend to want to reciprocate and get back. The liking principle, we like to do business with those we like, right? You don't do business with their friends. Consensus or social proof, which is a very powerful one right now for like online medium and advertising. But it's we look to the evidence of what others are doing to show us what we should do many times. The authority principle, we look to trustworthy, credible experts who know more about a topic than we do to tell us what we should do, because we don't have time to be the expert in everything. But it was the fifth one, you know, we talked about scarcity already, but it was this fifth one, if you will, consistency. That was the light bulb for me. The idea that when you get somebody to make a real commitment, when they take a stand on an issue, put money into the game, whatever, there's a lot of external and internal pressure on them to stay consistent and follow through and do with what they said they were going to do. And you know it's true if you think about the opposite of that word. What do we call people who are inconsistent, who don't do what they said they were going to do?
We have a negative impression, right?
It's universal that that's a bad thing to be associated with. So that's kind of the external pressure. So I started thinking about it and I thought, well, if people do what they said they were going to do, then why aren't people coming back for their treatment when they said they would? Why aren't they showing up for their appointment when they said they would? Why am I not seeing that behavior? And it hit me hard in that moment. I was like, it's because I'm not really getting the right type of commitments. And if I can change that and really understand that and strategize around that, could that be a game changer for my practices and what I'm seeing, but for my team, for my patients, for everybody's behavior? And I couldn't believe the change. Because again, it's stuff taps into, and this is what really intrigued me about it. It's not my opinion on things. This stuff is based in science. It's been tested. It's been proven. It's reproducible. It's learnable. And it really taps into the majority of the reasons on how people make their decisions. And it's not the stuff we think it is. And people don't even know what it is for the most part. But these principles are what they're really leaning towards the majority of the time to make a decision.
Coming back to the commitment and consistency piece just for a second, with respect to appointment commitment, because that was the issue. People weren't turning up. People weren't showing up. There'll be some people on this podcast who are already familiar with Cialdini's work. There'll be some who are going to discover it as a result of today. And if that's you, I'd encourage you to immerse yourself in it. It's wonderful. But specifically what we do in our practice is we'd be making an appointment. We'll be saying, you know, Chris, we've got you scheduled for, you know, Tuesday at 3:00. So you'll be okay for that appointment. And what I'm really looking from you is, yes, Jesse, I'll be there. And we can phrase that question any which way we like. But what I'm looking for from you is this, yes, I'm going to show up, turn up, because as soon as I get that commitment from you, you are internally wired to want to fulfill that commitment, correct?
Definitely.
So how do you do that in practice? Is it a similar process to what you do in your practice? I'm just trying to give something tangible and practical here.
Definitely. So when we go back to the commitments, we got to ask ourselves this. Well, if we're not getting commitments or the right kind, what kind do we need to get? And the key three most important ones are, number one, people need to feel like they had a choice. They have to have at least two options in whatever you're presenting, an appointment time, a treatment. Even if you think there's only one option, they have to feel like there's two, right? Otherwise, if they don't have a choice, they didn't commit to it. So we need a voluntary commitment. Second level is that we need an active commitment, meaning they got to put money into it. They got to write it down, because people live up to what they write down, or they at least have to tell you and speak it to you that they'll do it. And then the last one is the public nature. The more people that know you said you were going to do it, the more of that external pressure for you to follow through and do it. So the way we do our appointments, and this is the language I use, this is how I got my no-show rate down from 13% to 3%. And all I did was get more commitments. And it starts out with giving them a choice of appointment times. And you always present it as two options. This week or next week, morning or afternoon, 2:00 or 4:00. Well, I can only do Wednesdays. Okay, this Wednesday or next Wednesday, right? You can always present your options in two choices. Let them pick, but every time they're selecting something, they're making more of a commitment. Once you get them down to the appointment time you have available and you say, great, I got you down this day and time, will you please call me if you need to cancel or reschedule this appointment? And you wait for them to say, sure, yes. Okay, great. I'll let the other team members know you're going to call us if you can't make it. meaning everybody up front knows you said you were going to do this. So you're trying to add more public nature to it. Oh, and by the way, before you go, can you repeat back the day and time of your appointment just so I make sure I have it right in my computer? We're on the same page. Because what does it tell you if they cannot repeat back the day and time of their appointment?
Of course, they haven't taken it in, right?
No, which means they weren't coming, right? I think I'd rather know that now than be surprised by that later. So just doing some simple, and then of course, the last question we like to ask is, oh, and while I have you on the phone, is there anyone else we can make an appointment for?
Yeah, very similar to us. And we call that multiplying the booking. And one of my clients, on average, is picking up 3 new patients a day just by that question. And there's a couple of keys to that question. It's just to ask it routinely, to not prejudge the outcome, and to ask it from a point of view of just being helpful. And we're just trying to help.
Well, and people forget their mindset when they're making their own appointment is they're thinking about themselves. And they really, in that moment, forget they have other people to make appointments for. So by saying, is there anyone we can make another appointment for, it actually opens the door and reminds them, oh yeah, I got to, you know what, let me get my husband in, let me get the kids in, let me get whoever in, because they forget in that moment. So it's a reminder. And also, I love that the we, is there anyone we can make an appointment for, not is there anyone you need to make an appointment for? Because we, Dr. Cialdini talks about this in the new book, Persuasion, it's unity. It's all about unitizing language. Well, it's not you versus me, it's we. We're on the same team. It's a partnership.
Yeah, lovely. That's fantastic. Interesting conversation about the commitment and consistency part, Chris, because a couple of years ago, just how I invoked commitment and consistency on myself in the sense that, well, I was going to run this half marathon. And I thought, if I run a half marathon, I'll lose some weight. So just to give an example is that I went out to Facebook and announced I was going to run this half marathon. So public declaration, trained, effortful, raised money to give to charity for it. So you can't back out now. And interestingly enough, the week leading up to the half marathon, I had a cold, a head cold. If I hadn't made that commitment and consistency, I would have backed out because I felt rubbish. But as it is, it was the fact that I'd made the declaration, made it publicly, raised money, trained hard, all that sort of stuff. I had to go through with it, right? And I may have limped over the finish line and I may have looked like I was in need of CPR and I may have had a friend take a photo of me looking less than glamorous and post that to social media, but it was done. And I think the same principles, what you're talking about, apply. So it's really cool. I want to just talk a little bit about some of the other principles of influence because it's a topic that keeps on giving. It's a wonderful topic that you can go deep and wide into. We spoke a little bit about concept of consistency and commitment. I wanted to touch on the other work of Cialdini's, and that is comparison, contrast comparison, right? So tell me, how did you apply that in your practice? Because I'm curious to understand what you guys did versus what we did and see what tips come up for the audience.
Yeah, totally. Well, and that contrast, even though it's not a principle, and I asked Dr. Cialdini about it because we talk about it in our persuasion workshops that I teach. We teach on it, this phenomenon. Because it's everywhere. It's always present. You can always use and tap into it. But he never mentioned it in his original principles. And he said that it's truthfully because when he did his research and he kind of dressed up and pretended to be somebody looking for sales training and kind of went to see the people who were influencing us the most to say yes, what were they doing? What were their techniques? What was their language? He saw a pattern amongst all of them. And that's kind of what the six principles were. That was what he saw everybody was using. And so he did his research on those things to prove they exist and what made it tick. But he said, knowing what he knows now, in his opinion, contrast would be the seventh principle because it's that powerful and it's everywhere. And it really is what people are using to make the majority of their decisions. They're just comparing and contrasting things in the moment. So one of the things we try to do is this is how you turn somebody's dental need into a dental want, right? Because we all know people don't spend money on what they need unless it's a life or death situation. But they always spend money on what they want. You got to figure out a way to contrast them to something or get them to contrast it in a way that works out more times in your favor than not. So the idea is, and one of the worst mistakes you can make is you think they need a crown and you're going to start out by telling them that you need a crown and that's $1,200. Immediately, whenever the financial arrangement is presented and they hear $1,200 first, they're going to they always compare it to something. And the danger is when you let them control what they compare it to. That's how we use contra, right? It's like asking somebody, do you want the good news or the bad news? And you're letting them control the outcome of that, right? Because if you want the good news to sound better, then you start with the bad news, right? and vice versa. So if you want the good news to sound better and they start with the good news, it's not going to sound better. So we got to control that, right? So if you let them control it, they're going to think, geez, $1,200. My house payment's not $1,200. My car payment's not $1,200. I guess I can't afford this. And they've already mentally shut you down in 5 seconds, but you never hear it because of that contrast rule. So instead, what I like to do is before I tell them what they need today, whatever that is dental-wise, I like to picture in my mind and use scarcity and say, well, play it out in my head. Is this thing going to get better over time? Is it going to get worse? And most of the time, it's going to get worse. And the truth about people is what I know from them at their core is if they really knew what we knew and how bad it was going to get, that it was going to cost them more time, money, pain by waiting more visits, most people would prefer to not let that happen, to reprioritize it and get it done today or find a way to get it done. So I like to anchor them to something else first before I talk about like our price. So I'll say, well, all right, here's your decay. If it gets any deeper than this, let's say option one is, because remember, people need two choices. Option one is we do nothing. But here's what's going to happen. The decay is going to keep on going. It's going to get to the nerve. It's probably going to cause an infection. It's probably going to cause pain. It's going to take me a couple of visits to fix it. I may have to send you to a specialist to fix it. So you got to go somewhere else. People hate going somewhere else. And if we wait to fix it, we're looking at a root canal buildup in a crown, and that's $3,600. So I want to anchor them to that fee. Like, oh, holy crap, I can't afford $3,600. Well, that's right. But the good news is we're not there yet. Option two is, if we get to it today, is a crown. And that's really only $1,200. And after your insurance, it's only $800. And I tell you what, we'll do $400 today and $400 next month when we deliver it. Does that work for you? So now we've taken something, $3,600 is what we anchored them to. They compared that and said, I definitely can't do that. So I don't want it to get to that. We told them our actual fee, but I used contrast and figured out a way that I could break up the price into smaller and smaller pieces. And I call that taking them down the price stairs, right? And so the more you can do that for your procedures, watch the change in people's behavior and them saying yes.
Yeah, so I think that's really interesting because I want to pick up on a point here, Chris, and it's an important point, I think, because you and I are wired the same way in many senses. I do a very similar process in what I do. And I've also found that what you've done is effectively, in a way, downsold from the endo, the root canal and the crown down into the crown, right? And you've used the time frames and so on and so forth. It's really interesting because there's a traditional paradigm of stepping people up the stairs in terms of suboptimal treatment, okay treatment, best treatment kind of routine. And I actually don't find that particularly helpful. Do you have a thought around that?
Yeah. So interesting study, if you got a second, that will fit the point perfectly, right? So a group of orthodontists came to the group and wanted help because they were having trouble selling Invisalign. So this is back in 2003 when Invisalign was fresh to the market in the States. Only specialists were doing it. The orthodontists were promoting it and using it. And these were some of the best orthodontists in the U.S. Like, these guys were super successful. One guy had his own private plane. Another guy had his own private island. You know you're doing well when you got your own island, okay?
Yeah.
But they couldn't sell Invisalign. So they wanted help. So they brought Cialdini's group in to consult. They came in and they noticed, well, they saw, how are you presenting your treatment? And they were taking them up the price stairs, like you just said. So they would say, all right, Mrs. Jones, you need short-term orthodontics. That's one option. We could do that for $2,000. We could do long-term bracket wire therapy for $4,000. I could do long-term cosmetic bracket wire therapy, so white wires, white brackets, for $6,000. Or I could do Invisalign for $8,000, right? You can hear it, $2,000, $4,000, $6,000, $8,000. Just the contrast alone going up the stairs works against you. And they said, okay, well, let's do a cool experiment. In half the group, the people that come in, take them up the stairs, do what you've always done. And the other half of the group, just humorous, just flip the order. Start with the biggest and best, the 8,000, and go down from there. So 8,000, 6,000, 4,000, 2,000. And they asked them, they said, well, how much of a change, an increase in your $8,000 Invisalign sales needs to happen for you to think this was a fun experiment, that it was worthwhile? And they were like, I don't know, if we had like a 5% increase in sales of Invisalign, we'd be happy. And they said, okay, well, how much has to happen for you to be like ecstatic, like we knocked it out of the park? Right? You're really happy we did this. And they said, well, geez, if we had a 20% increase in sales of Invisalign, oh my God, that'd be a game changer for us. And I always tell people, picture the most expensive thing you could sell in your practice today. A $20,000 hybrid with implant, whatever that is, right? It's a full mouth of veneers. how many of you would be ecstatic with a 20% increase in sales of those this year? Anybody out there?
Yeah. I think all the hands are immediate. It's people driving. If you're driving and listening to this, keep your hands on the wheel and just lift a finger, pinky.
Or put your kneecaps on the wheel.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, right? Everybody would. So that they ran the test. And what they found was when they took people down the price there, so they started with $8,000 and went down to $2,000, that alone led to a 540% increase in sales of the $8,000 business. 5.5 times more quantity. But even more interesting, this is what really sold me on it, was not only did they sell more of the best thing, they sold more of every other option underneath it. So more people bought at the $6,000 level than at the previous group. More people bought at $4,000, and even more people bought at $2,000. So more people left with some treatment than in the other group. So revenue overall went up. And so the way I describe it is, when you take people up the price stairs, you set the stage for a no. When you take people down the stairs, you set the stage for a yes, for no other reason than the contrast and the order and the sequence in which you presented it.
I agree 1,000% with that, Chris, because the standard dogma is up the price stairs. And for years, I've been going wrong way, turn around, go back. And you've got to go down the stairs. You've got to do that descension into from highest to lowest. And you're right, it's the contrast, because if you get that wrong, it kills you.
That's what people are using to make their decisions. They're not even listening to what you're saying. It's just the contrast working against you is like, that's enough for them to go, nope.
Exactly. So in Cialdini's work, he talks a lot about contrast, obviously, but he also talks about shortcuts. And I have to tell you a little story, because before I really understood Cialdini's work, I used a shortcut without meaning to use a shortcut, because I had a practice. It was a long time ago now, and I didn't quite know enough about the management of the practice like I know now. I was doing things differently, but I was so busy. And at that time, I thought, I just don't want as many patients, which is ludicrous. I understand how ridiculous that sounds. Okay. But at the time, that's where I was up to. I thought, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to put my prices up. And you know exactly where I'm going with this, because I suddenly got busier, which was completely counter to what I was trying to achieve on one hand. But we made good money from it, which was terrific. So Chris, you'll know the shortcut I've just used in that. And I didn't know what shortcut I was using at the time, because I didn't understand the principles of influence at that point. Can you speak to the shortcuts in general, and specifically what I did inadvertently, because it was a fluke, a good fluke, but at the time I didn't understand it.
Yeah. Well, it's this idea is that we think that people are making their decisions based on rational thought and deep reflection and really listening to what we're telling them, when the reality is they're looking for little shortcuts, little cues, little triggers to signal that I should say yes to this. And usually when I do, it's a good thing for me. And so one of the shortcuts, and that's what a cue and a trigger is, the six principles are six shortcuts, right? And what you kind of hit on is a big one that people use to determine the value. So when 25% of the people out there will buy it because it, for no other reason than it's the most expensive thing, because they associate expensive with, oh, well, then it must be good and I want the best. And so that was the shortcut you tapped into. And people that want the best, they're going to pay the best. And you keep raising it.
Yeah, exactly. And of course, there's a point where it becomes ridiculous. But I, as I said, I just didn't understand it at the time. And of course, once I read Cialdini's stuff, I just went, oh, face palm. I get what I did inadvertently. So what other shortcuts do you think could be useful in dental practice? So, because there's the price, the expensive equals good. What other shortcuts do you see coming up that would allow people to position themselves, or indeed to get treatment over the line, or market, or so on?
Well, even simple stuff like, so I don't know, Cialdini has his newest book out called Persuasion. I don't know if you've looked into that or read that one.
Yeah, I have, yeah.
So we're just now launching a workshop on that, but the idea of persuasion and how it pairs with persuasion, it's like the 1-2 punch that are extremely powerful. And so persuasion is all about mindsets and creating the right mindset. So one of the shortcuts you can do is creating the mindset of the patient who's going to say yes to your treatment, getting that patient to commit to that mindset before they ever even get in front of you. So two little shortcuts I tapped into was, I knew that somebody that I want to say yes to my treatment, and who makes up probably 80% of my patient base, are proactive mindsets, people that don't want it to get worse, right? They're going to be sensitive to the scarcity message, because I want them to do the crowns, the fillings today instead of the worst stuff later. And that's what keeps my day-to-day stuff going and the practice running. So I need them to have that proactive mindset. And I started thinking about that. Well, how can I get them to commit to that? in a persuasive manner, which was I started early. So I put that as the first question on my new patient form. When it comes to your oral health, do you prefer to be proactive or reactive? I give them a choice, right? Do you prefer to be proactive, meaning you want to avoid pain, discomfort, letting things get worse, costing you more money later? Or do you prefer to be reactive, meaning you're okay letting the wheels fall off the bus, even if it costs you more time, money, and pain later?
That is fabulous. You are just putting them in a box that they've now, well, they've put themselves in a box, right?
They put themselves in a box and they chose it every step of the way.
Every step of the way. And now they're going to act in accordance with what box they've put themselves in.
That's it. And my thing is, I don't care what they choose. I just got a strategy for both.
Yeah, yeah. I love that. Ladies and gents, you better write that down. And if you're driving, pull over right now and just write that down, because that is just marketing gold and case acceptance gold right there. And I guarantee you that one tip alone is going to make you a lot of money and help your patients achieve much better care ultimately as well. Ladies and gentlemen, we are speaking to Dr. Chris Phelps all the way from North Carolina, and you can check him out on strategicpracticeaustralia.com. Chris, you are visiting down under. We're going to be greeting you with the anthem from the Australia 2, which is the Land Down Under song. You'll see kangaroos, you'll see lamingtons, you'll see meat pies, you'll see all the Australian cliches and icons. Tell us, when you do come down to Australia, you're coming to Sydney and Melbourne, and you're going to be talking about persuasion and persuasion and marketing and case presentation, all those things, right? So all the stuff we've gone through, that's what you're covering, right?
Yep, exactly. All the ways I've used to creative ways in external marketing, internal marketing, and what I call grassroots marketing, what I wrote my book about, why membership plans, what they are, and why you need to be doing those for patients without insurance right now. That's our future, I think, for all of us in every country, to get out of the insurance game altogether and to fight the corporate groups that are running rampant. We're going to talk about that, and as well as, well, in the case acceptance side. Now we got them in the chair. How do we get more?
Yeah, yeah. So just on memberships, because memberships and recurring models, recurring revenue models are something I've been interested and involved in for a long, long time. And I happen to agree with you. I think the world is turning into a subscription kind of world, whether it's Netflix, Spotify, iTunes Music, Apple Music, whatever it is. And I think it's becoming more and more common in dentistry to move to membership. And so I wondered if you could just talk about that trend specifically, and then we'll dive into the specifics of it, of how to implement it. But do you see that as a big change in our industry as things progress?
Oh, big time. You know, like even the trend here in the States, the number of people that have dental insurance has gone down every year. So now less than 35% of our population has it, which means the majority don't have insurance. And what I found in my research and in talking to communities was that my best client, my best patient, who's retired, if you will, values their oral health still, but they're not going to the dentist because they think they can't because they don't have insurance. So they're not going to see anybody. And so really tapping into that and creating this membership plan, I didn't realize how powerful it would be to my practice growth. But from a scientific standpoint, I saw a study, again, that summed it all up for me. And it was do you guys have Costco?
Yes, we do.
Membership model, right? You got to pay some amount of money. In the States, it's $55 for the year to be a member for the rights to shop there. Or we have Walmart, right? Is another competitor of Costco, but you don't have to pay any money to shop at Walmart. You just walk right in and buy whatever you want. So in theory, you can buy the same TV at Costco that you can at Walmart. So they did a study measuring the shopping and buying habits of people that shopped at Walmart versus Costco to try to see, well, we would think in theory that more people would shop at Walmart and spend more, right? Well, come to find out, what they saw was that Costco shoppers spend 247% more per trip than Walmart shoppers every time. And so it really solidified this idea, going back to commitment and consistency again. When people buy a membership plan, they commit to a membership plan mindset, which means if I'm going to spend my money anywhere, where should it be? Here. Why? Because I save money. I'm a member. Right. So people who are on a membership plan spend more money than people who are not on a membership plan. And that's the future, at least for the private practices, the way I see it.
No, I think it is too. And I think it's actually the thing I also really appreciate and like about this particular model is it provides value in the business. So again, thinking a little bit beyond the revenue streams and so on, it creates value in the business. So you've got a patient base that's committing money on a monthly basis or whatever frequency that charge is occurring. And that gives certainty of revenue. It minimizes risk. So if you were ever wanting to sell your business and you've got a membership plan attached to it, in my view at least, that's a more valuable business than one that does not.
Oh, by far. And it's another one of those, I call it anchors, that keep the patient at the practice. So again, it closes the patient attrition door, because suddenly the practice across the street they get an ad from, the shiny new office, if you will, doesn't seem so exciting because they don't have a membership plan. Why would I go here? I like the doctor. I like the team. Oh, and we have a membership plan. So it's the third anchor to help keep them there and close that back door.
I'm in 100% agreement with you, mate. That's fantastic. Hey, Chris, you've been incredibly generous with your time today. I also realize that it's the evening over there for you and the daytime here for us. So firstly, the good news is that the day does come around tomorrow, so you're all good. But I wanted to say thank you so much for taking the time out of your evening to come and hang with us. You've been incredibly generous, not just with your time, but with your knowledge and your insights, of course. But we are looking forward to seeing you down under. We're looking forward to welcoming you to our shores, and we hope that you'll be coming down frequently and regularly, and I hope we can hang out and have a beer.
I'd love that. Thank you.
Thanks so much, mate. Cheers.
Thank you for listening to the Savvy Dentist podcast with Dr. Jesse Green. For more free tools and resources, join the free Facebook group. Visit drjessegreen.com/Facebook. And for more episodes, visit drjessegreen.com/Savvy Dentist.